cause the blues is done spread. Rocks in my bed, rocks in my bed. Of all the people I see, why do they pick on poor me and put rocks in my bed? So how can I sleep with rocks in my bed? My heart is heavy, heavy as lead, because the blues is done spread. Rocks in my bed. All the people I see, why do they keep picking on poor little me and put rocks in my bed? All night long I weep, so how can I sleep with rocks in my bed?
That's Sarah Vaughan with Rocks in My Bed. It's from the remastered album Duke Ellington Songbook Volume 2, released in 2006. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and today two pieces of a program that I hope you would stick around for and enjoy and learn something from. In the second half, the undemocratic party that helps Hillary Clinton win without actually winning. But first, the Supreme Court and the not-so-endearing legacy of Justice Antonin Scalia. Dr. Gerald Horn is with us. He is the John Jay and Rebecca Moore's Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston and a frequent analyst of world affairs on Lead Stories. He discusses today the enduring impact of Justice Antonin Scalia on the U.S. Supreme Court, decisions that reflect both the court's politicization and rightward shift in recent decades, and whether President Obama's nominee to replace Scalia could substantially change the tenor and direction of the court. Dr. Horn, as you know, is the author of several books, more than 30, in fact, most recently publishing Confronting Black Jacobins, The United States, The Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic, and just prior to that, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance, and the Origins of the United States of America. He's considered one of the finest historians that we have in America today, and we are delighted always to have him with us because we always learn a lot. Thanks, Gerald, for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I imagine, let me get this out first, I imagine you're working on yet another book. What is it?
Well, you may know that my biography of Paul Robeson just came out a few days ago, and I've been out on the road, in fact, talking about it.
Well, certainly we will have to have you back here to talk about Paul Robeson, a giant of a man, and we hope we could schedule that very soon. But let's talk about the death of Antonin Scalia, U.S. Supreme Court Justice, known for his devotion to originalism and textualism. What the heck does that mean?
Supposedly, it means a devotion to what the so-called founding fathers, the framers of the Constitution, intended or meant when they framed the Constitution in the late 18th century. The problem, of course, is that the records from the Constitutional Convention are not comprehensive, and it's difficult to divine what these framers intended. And in any case, these framers may not have contemplated, believe it or not, the rise of the Internet or automobiles or telephones or modern society generally. And so it becomes rather difficult to apply an 18th century document to the 21st century. In any case, it was applied by Justice Antonin Scalia inconsistently. That is to say that it's clear that the radical Republicans who surged to influence in the United States in the aftermath of the U.S. Civil War, 1861 to 1865, had a more capacious understanding of what should occur with regard to the newly freed Africans than Justice Antonin Scalia admits. In fact, he does not necessarily apply textualism or originalism to the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendments of the U.S. Constitution. In many ways, this doctrine was masquerading as a doctrine, but in fact, it was no more than naked politics, as evidenced by the fact that Justice Antonin Scalia was an intellectual architect of the notorious Bush versus Gore decision in the year 2000, which ignored the plain wording of the Constitution with regard to how contested elections should be settled, and handed the presidency and the White House to George W. Bush. One of his lasting legacies, I'm afraid, occurred just before his passing when he was part of the majority that in many ways has sought to scuttle the climate accord in Paris, just negotiated late last year, by seeking to negate President Obama's attempt to more rigorously regulate the coal power plants. Justice Antonin Scalia, in many ways, however, was a prototypical so-called white American. That is to say that his roots were in Sicily. And we all know that in Italy, of which Sicily is a part, there's this disdain for Sicilians. That is to say, they have this idea that Africa starts south of Rome. That is to say that Sicily, in many ways, should be derided because over the years and over the centuries, it's been subjected to repeated interventions and invasions by those from North Africa. But rather than adopt a sensitivity to people of African descent or the oppressed generally, Antonin Scalia, who was born in Trenton, New Jersey, and grew up in Queens, took the opposing point of view, even though by his own admission he was probably turned down for admission to Princeton University because of a Sicilian background. It's very typical, I'm afraid, of many who migrate from Europe to the United States, rather than seeing their status as being something that they would like to extend, just to say this elevated, exalted status that so-called white Americans enjoy in North America, they try to shut the door and, in fact, try to adopt the worst habit of the elite and the bourgeoisie who they have aped. It's reflected, I'm afraid, as well in the approach to the current president. That is to say, the U.S. left, to their credit, has been very expert in analyzing the defects and the faults of this particular Barack Obama administration. Although I should say parenthetically that many of these people who are doing the analyzing supported his biggest blunder, the ill-advised invasion of Libya in 2011, which has led to ISIS developing a foothold in North Africa, but that's another story for another day. But at the same time, the left has not been very good at analyzing the raw white supremacy that has animated the opposition to Barack Obama, that is now animating the rise of Donald J. Trump, who has a good deal of support from the Euro-American working class and middle class. And because of this inability to analyze the Trump phenomenon or even do a balanced critique of the Obama administration, I think it's put all of us in danger and in peril.
Well, I want to go, by the way, I should let the audience know that among other things, you are pretty well versed in the area of law, yourself being a lawyer of great note. I just wanted to mention that, so you're not just talking about it from a historical point of view. I want to draw a bit from the book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, and the ripple effects into the formation of the U.S. Supreme Court, which brings us to this question of originalism and textualism and the so-called thinking of the founding fathers, the visions of the founding fathers about how do you, by law, construct a society that reflects essentially the slavocracy of the South. Could you talk about that and how it continued even up until today in the U.S. Supreme Court with this, it's covered by this idea that the in the court today, what's I think the spirit of the so-called colonial revolution lives in the thinking of people like Scalia and his protege Clarence Thomas about the values, quote unquote, of the slavocracy South.
Well, I think that this is best summed up by reference to that eminent philosopher known as Whoopi Goldberg. You might recall that during the 2008 presidential election on her program, The View, she entertained then-presidential aspirant Senator John McCain, who announced that in appointing Supreme Court justices, he was going to appoint justices like Scalia, who had a so-called originalist interpretation of the Constitution. And Whoopi Goldberg's response was, does that mean we all go back to slavery? And I think that with that offhand comment, she exposed the fragility and the debility of this originalist philosophy, because the Constitution, devised in the late 18th century, did not contemplate freedom and liberty for the enslaved. That's what led to the U.S. Civil War. I just exposed my students here in Texas just a few days ago to the story of Otabenga. Otabenga was an African kidnapped from the Congo 4 decades after the U.S. Civil War concluded, that is to say in the early 1900s, and was brought to St. Louis and then New York and put in a zoo. And that was because the Euro-American elite and a good deal of so-called white opinion did not see Africans as being part of the human family. They saw us as being part of the chimpanzee and monkey family, of course. They saw us as animals. They saw us as livestock. And that is one of the reasons why the Constitution has been so difficult to apply to black people in particular and those not defined as white in general, because the Constitution was not designed for us. All of those leftists who are cheering for the Constitution need to absorb that sobering fact and really need to come back to reality. That is to say, this idea that this was some great document is poppycock, it's balderdash. It was a document intended, number one, to cement a slave society, and it was a document meant in some ways to attract European migrants across the Atlantic to a raucous war zone where they would have to confront rebellious Africans and marauding Native Americans. And by offering a package of civil rights and civil liberties, albeit depriving many of them of the right to vote, that is to say these European migrants, it was felt that this would be enough to attract the thousands upon thousands of European migrants that would be needed to subdue a continent. And fundamentally, it worked. But the problem is that so-called original sin has yet to be corrected. That is to say that there is still a difficulty in applying the Constitution to the rest of us, which is one of the reasons why you see us being executed on videotape without due process of law, with the perpetrators oftentimes going free. This, in many ways, is the ultimate symbol of the failed judicial legacy of one Antonin Scalia.
Just the same, he managed, because these appointments to the U.S. Supreme Court are lifelong, in a span of about 3 decades, he managed somehow to exert so much influence as to maintain the vestiges of that kind of thinking of the slaveocracy South. How is that likely to change now, if you think it is, and in which direction would it go with the appointment of a replacement by President Obama?
Well, it's difficult to say, but I will say this, I will venture this opinion, that even a 4-4 split between conservatives and non-conservatives on the high court in many ways is a victory for humanity. That is to say, not only with regard to specific cases, for example, the case that was slated to overturn the thrust and the functioning of public sector unions like the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, the Service Employees International Union, that case will probably wind up as a 4-4 split, which will lead to a lower court ruling standing that validates the functioning of these public sector unions. Likewise, for a case from Texas that was slated to further circumscribe the reproductive freedoms of women, that case will probably end up not being a victory for the anti-choice movement. So in many ways, this 4-4 split is going to redound to our benefit. Now, whether or not Barack Obama will be able to appoint another justice is an open question. The Republicans, as you know, have dug in their heels. Contrary to history, they're saying that because this is an election year, Obama, despite the fact that he has 340-plus days left in his administration, does not have the right to appoint a justice. I guess you recall the three-fifths compromise from the original U.S. Constitution, which counted people of African descent as three-fifths of a human being. So I guess that still rules. Barack Obama is three-fifths of a president. He's not five-fifths a president. He's not a whole president. He can't make appointments like a normalized president could. And this may jeopardize the Senate reelection of people like Mark Kirk of Illinois and Ron Johnson of Wisconsin and Kelly Ayotte of New Hampshire, who are somehow viewed as so-called moderate Republicans, which I thought had been a dead species. But they face even more threat and danger from the Republican Party base, which is open to virtually any tactic, and I choose my words carefully, to apply to the so-called moderate Republicans if they do not go along with the hard right consensus, which is to deny Mr. Obama an opportunity to appoint another justice, not only in terms of confirmation, but even up to and including having hearings. And I think that what this reflects is something that I'm afraid that many of our friends on the left have not been able to absorb once again politically, which is that the Republican Party base, which is disproportionately comprised of Euro-American working class and middle class elements, oftentimes is to the right of the elite. I'm doing a book now, I'm researching a book on the anti-apartheid movement and the movement to bring democracy to South Africa with the first elections in 1994. And one of the things that strikes me as I go through, say, the papers of Ronald Wilson Reagan at his presidential library in Simi Valley, California, is how the Reagan administration was oftentimes willing to bend to reality. That is to say, if you were able to organize a free South Africa movement and a global anti-apartheid movement and divestment movements on college campuses, they were willing to bend to reality and willing to bend to this mass pressure. But it was the base that was lighting a fire under the Reagan administration and said, no way, Jose, do not bend to this reality. I was reading one letter the other day where this guy was saying, why are you calling for the freedom of Nelson Mandela as a good faith gesture by the Pretoria regime? My question is, why wasn't Mandela executed back in 1964 instead of put in prison? And so that dynamic, that is to say, this fearsomely reactionary right-wing base of the Republican Party grounded in the working class and middle class is still operative. They're the ones who are propelling Donald Trump and Ted Cruz. They're the ones who will probably lead to President Obama not getting an opportunity to appoint a successor to Antonin Scalia.
Is it a lost cause to even contemplate the idea of a depoliticized U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, it very well may be. It's obvious that the current Supreme Court, particularly the conservative bulwark, particularly Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito in particular, are politicians in robes. I mean, let's be clear. I mean, I don't think, particularly with regard to that notorious Bush versus Gore decision in 2000, which handed the White House to George W. Bush, it's probably one of the worst reasoned opinions, and it has a lot of competition, in U.S. Supreme Court history, ranking with Plessy versus Ferguson, which sanctified Jim Crow in the 1890s, or the Dred Scott decision in the 1850s, which sanctified slavery and said white men have no rights, that black men have no rights, that white men are bound to respect. This was further evidence, if any was needed, that the conservatives in particular dance to the tune of the right wing. They're very reluctant and loath to circumvent the wishes of the right wing, Antonin Scalia was foremost and uppermost in that category. However, I think that we should still nonetheless clamor for the right and opportunity of Barack Obama to appoint Scalia's successor, because this is part of a larger strategy that's taking place. That is to say, my own opinion is that the thinkers, or those who pass for thinkers in the right-wing Republican Party, have come to the conclusion that for some time to come, there's going to be difficulty in electing a Republican president. We all know that the Republicans have lost the popular vote repeatedly since the year 2000. And that is one of the reasons why it seems to me they have a long-term strategy of circumscribing the power of the executive. That is to say, that is the import of the Supreme Court taking the case with regard to immigration, where at least before Antonin Scalia's passing, they were probably going to circumscribe the president's ability to execute the laws with regard to immigration, because immigration, as you know, is a hot-button issue for the base. That's what's helped to catapult Donald J. Trump into the lead of Republican Party presidential aspirants. That's one of the reasons, it seems to me, that they scuttled Mr. Obama's regulation or attempt to regulate coal power plants, because of this long-term strategy of circumscribing the right of the executive to intervene with regard to the environment. And it seems to me that they also want to circumscribe the ability of a president to appoint Supreme Court justices as well. And this battle over the right of Obama to appoint a successor to Scalia needs to be seen in that wider and larger context. In other words, the right wing is trying to fundamentally alter the political architecture of the United States of America with results that are not necessarily foreseeable, although it is foreseeable that the Republicans feel that they have a good chance of controlling the House and the Senate for some time to come, and thereby executing their diabolical right-wing schemes, and having the ability of a president who is not a Republican, having their ability circumscribed, if not circumvented.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today and advancing this discussion on Justice Alito, his impact, his enduring impact, and not so endearing impact. And we will be talking soon, of course, about your latest book on Paul Robeson. I hope we can schedule something soon. I know you're busy researching your other book, but thanks so much for being with us today, Gerald.
Thank you for inviting me.
All righty. We'll take this break and come back and talk about how Hillary is winning without actually winning. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. Well, Bernie Sanders' underdog campaign almost torpedoed Hillary Clinton in Iowa, and she definitely felt the burn in New Hampshire with Sanders' double-digit 22-point victory margin. Yet, she seems to be winning. Big. How does this happen? Well, it's because the undemocratic Democratic Party has a system called the delegate system and a super delegate system that allows this to happen. So let's talk a bit about that. How is it possible that you could win so handsomely. I mean, you win decisively an election, and yet your opponent is ahead of you. Sounds odd, does it? But it's in fact the way it works. And this is yet another reason why the Clintons and the Democratic Party need to be fired. It's so rigged. The whole system is so fixed. It doesn't make sense. All right. So what they have is a delegate system. Technically, if you win in any given state, it should be kind of winner takes all, right? You have delegates. These are the party people, party officials. And if you win a state, you carry all of the delegates in that state, okay? And then they go to the convention. This will happen in June in Philadelphia. I think it's June. And they are the ones who will be voting for the nominee. They will be the ones deciding who the nominee of the party will be, who will then go toe-to-toe with the Republican candidate in the general election. This is how it works. Now, this is the formula they devised. The Democratic formula, see, because the Democratic Party believes in democracy. And so it should be fair. but it ain't fair. It's just rigged. Okay. So now, by legal count, since Bernie Sanders, let's say, he came really close to toppling Hillary Clinton in Iowa, and he certainly trounced her in New Hampshire, so why is it that Hillary Clinton is outpacing him and actually is, at this moment, a winner? She is actually winning the election, despite the popular vote. It turns out that you have in the Democratic Party this system, but there's another system that is parallel to that system. And this is, they have a system of something called super delegates. They're even more important than the regular delegates. These are party officials, and they get to decide whether they are going to go with candidate A or candidate B. They're not part of the herd that the candidates should automatically get if they carry a particular state. It's no winner-take-all. It's winner-take-all for the regulars, but for the super-delegates, they could decide where they want to go. They could decide, even if, let's say, Sanders won in New Hampshire, they could decide they don't need to go along with the rest of the regular delegates. We could decide who we want to go with. And guess what? They've been deciding that they want to go to Hillary so far. So far, the superdelegate count seems to be favoring Hillary Clinton. Now, the public is being made to believe that it's a fair process. It isn't a fair process. It's a rigged process. So even those people showing up to the polls, you know, there's a meeting going on now with Sharpton and others trying to pretend how best to package the fact that they're going to go with Hillary, right? Because, of course, they believe in a democratic process. There's no democratic process here. So even while the delegates that Sanders is winning, he's winning because he's winning them via popular vote. The people vote. The delegates that go along with that vote would be his. That's the thinking. But then you have the superdelegate votes, and they're not reflected in that at all. So Hillary Clinton is racking up the superdelegates, and they are working night and day. She's got a whole army of people pressing the buttons of the superdelegates. and getting commitments from them now, even before elections are won. And she is making out, pardon the pun, like a bandit. So you see, I mean, you wonder, when is this stuff going to stop? Nothing is fair. This isn't a fair game. Why would Bernie Sanders, having trounced Hillary Clinton in New Hampshire, why should Hillary Clinton have the same number of delegates as he has? And why would people want to support a party that does business this way? This superdelegate secret group. Rules that don't seem to apply. People who have the inside track. And you make people go to the polls, bring your souls to the polls, and cast a vote. In fact, Jesse Jackson was interviewed just this morning. He's not endorsing anyone just yet, he says. He's taking on the more important job of encouraging people to vote. But of course, we know that in South Carolina, I told you from a while ago, South Carolina is where you need to look. The significance of South Carolina, even Hillary Clinton describes it. By the way, this is the words they're using to describe black voters. This is Hillary Clinton's, quote, firewall, unquote. Black people are now her firewall. And Jesse Jackson said just this morning on CNN that he is more interested in bringing people to vote. He's not going to take sides. He's not going to take sides because he can't take sides. He understands and accepts that he is a compromised person. He probably accepts that his clout is quite limited at this point. But he is nonetheless going to go out and do his duty to the Democratic Party and ask people to come out and vote, even though the system is rigged. Because that, in effect, is saying he's with Hillary. These people ought to be brought out in a public square somewhere and people given, you know, lots and lots of rotten tomatoes to throw at them. How does the Democratic Party actually suggest that the process of election is free and fair? And that the will of the people is going to prevail. Now, I'm not saying I'm for Sanders. I'm not saying I'm for Hillary. My views about this whole thing, and I'm going to come to it in a minute, to underscore my point that this party needs to be destroyed. How many ways are you going to frustrate the will of the people? How many ways are you going to deceive them? How many ways are you going to, do this parallel track thing where you make people believe they are actually participating in the democratic process and you have a whole different process at work that guarantees that whatever the will of the people is, there's a way to prevent it from going the way you want it to go. You as the voter, you decided, let's say, the people who voted for Bernie Sanders. Their comfort should be, look, we had a choice between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. We prefer Bernie, we're casting our votes for Bernie. Okay. If he wins, and he wins fair and square, he wins the popular vote by 22 points. He trounces Hillary. And how come she gets the same number of delegates? How does that work? How could you possibly continue to tell people this is a fair process? This is democracy. Bernie Sanders should get all of the delegates that go with winning. He didn't get it either in Iowa, although he tied Hillary Clinton. And in some cases, reports are that he actually won that election. And yet, Hillary Clinton still is ahead with the delegate count. There's some pretty strange math going on here. This is not fair dealing. This is hoodwinking. This is cheating. This is literally an insult to any notion of democracy. They're saying, well, you know, this is our system. And, you know, come convention time, the super delegates, that's the closeted delegates, the people who are held, the pocket delegates, the ones who are in the pocket that you are not seeing, they're free to decide eventually where they want to go. But that's not the point, is it? The point is, you're telling people to come out and vote. You're telling people, as the so-called Democratic Party, this is part of the democratic process. Come out and vote. It's about, you know, promoting this concept of your civic duty and participating in a democracy and so forth. You're telling them all the stuff that you know isn't necessarily true, and it's not going to work that way. This woman didn't win in New Hampshire. Bernie Sanders won. He won big. Give the man the delegates. Why do you have a process that actually countermands the will of the people, the popular vote? You have a way of nullifying the vote. This should be, by any definition, completely illegal. But they sanctified it. And that is why Hillary Clinton, although she is losing, she's losing an appeal, and she's lost big in New Hampshire, and she technically lost in Iowa, too. Don't forget, Bernie Sanders is running for the first time, right? He has a spit and chewing gum operation. It's not a big, well-financed campaign. So why is Hillary Clinton still ahead with delegates? With the delegate vote. And those are the people whose votes eventually will choose the nominee. The Democratic Party is now telling the public, we reserve the right to run a rigged operation. We don't have to respect your vote, but come out and vote anyway. Come out and vote, and we'll play this game, this charade, give you the belief, placate you, make you think you're participating and you're exercising your hard-won right to vote. But there's a way to undo everything it is you want to get done. There's a way to undermine your choice. There's a way to railroad your decision. And we've made it legal. We call it rules. Now, when I said to you, I repeat it all the time, this party needs to be destroyed. It needs to be dealt a lethal blow. It needs to learn a lesson the hard way. Because it is engaging in fraud. And for the life of me, I can't understand why people continue to support it. Especially the people most harmed by it. They're going to tell voters, well, the choice this year is between literally, you know, the good and the bad. The Republicans are really, really horrible, and you need to think about what would happen to you if the Republicans get into office. And they're going to do this, and they're going to do that, and make your life even more miserable. But the Democrats are killing you too. And they're killing the concept. They're killing the very principle. They're killing the whole idea of what it is, what it supposedly means to vote. They're in your face with it. They're part and parcel of it. They're nullifying your vote. And they have made it legal. And this isn't just about, you know, party rules. This is the power to nullify the vote. And people should be outraged about that. And for that alone, the Democratic Party needs to be destroyed. It needs to be punished very severely. It should not be supported. Or a tactic needs to be developed in order to send the message, a message vote. It says, we are moving strategically. You do not deserve the credibility or the support of the people when you act this way. When you, you know, but it's perfectly in line with the way the Clintons operate. That shady business. That's where they're most comfortable, in the swill. But my point is, the people are being hoodwinked, and the vote is literally being hijacked. Even at this early point in the 2016 campaign, the vote is being hijacked. Let it be fair and square. But because they have such contempt for the voter, because they have so little regard for the integrity of the process, because they think they, you know, this is how they get their kicks, they have the ultimate authority in deciding how a supposedly democratic process will turn out. They have the ability to make people go through all these hoops. They have volunteers in the streets. They have all this stuff going on to make it look like we are operating. But their behavior and their actions are no different from the same countries they criticize for rigged elections. This is a rigging of the election. And there ought to be universal condemnation of it. We don't need a Jesse Jackson to say, well, I'm not endorsing anyone. Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton, these people are the ones who should be up in arms about this. They should be very public about the fact that the Democratic Party is undemocratic. But they've accommodated this kind of thing. Fannie Lou Hamer would never have stood for that. Shirley Chisholm would never have stood for that. But they have these compromised leaders, these sycophants, these people who literally have turned the so-called civil rights movement into a business endeavor. It's the way they make money. It's how they get status and public acclamation. And so they tolerate this kind of corruption. They countenance it. And worse, they encourage everybody to be participants in it. We want you, says Jesse Jackson, I'm here to encourage black people to vote. And they will come out and vote. With, you know, a wink. Hillary Clinton is winking, laughing, having an inside joke. Look at them. We have the inside track. I could tell you right now we have the inside track because I have my super delegates in my pocket. And you guys could vote all you want. But I have insurance that even if I lose, I win. Now, I want all the feminists to tell me about Hillary's equal right to engage in these shenanigans as anybody else. I don't think so. I think people should be in the streets about it. I think there ought to be a movement all across America to absolutely punish this party for behaving this way, for undermining the integrity of the vote, for playing this kind of a horrible game. And these leaders that sit down with Hillary Clinton today, they're sitting down with her, supposedly talking with her about issues that are important. All the years this woman was in office, they didn't have any access to Hillary Clinton to talk about issues. And if they did, she wasn't able to deliver what they wanted or what they should have asked for and demanded. But even as she sits in the room with these nincompoops, the joke is on them. She knows that this is all, you know, for show. She knows she's guaranteed hundreds of delegates pledging their troth to her without her even having to ask. And this is how the sellout occurs in the, especially in communities of color, who are the people that are now Hillary Clinton's so-called political firewall, a firewall against defeat. It is time for everybody. I don't care who you want to vote for or don't want to vote for. But this is an affront. This is a major assault. This is an alarming way to behave, for a party to behave and to get away with it. So since the Democratic Party has no problem with this, since the leaders, the African American and Latino leaders, having no problems with this, since the party officials are part and parcel of this, punish them all. Punish this party severely. But let people know that this is wrong. This is absolutely wrong. And in my view, I would say it's illegal. Not only is it unethical, I think it's illegal. I think there should be lawsuits flying all over the place. This cannot be. This erodes the integrity of the vote, and we can't have a Democratic Party pulling this kind of nonsense in 2016 in front of your very face and telling you you're part of the democratic process and this is a party issue. This is how we run things. No, it's still about a vote. It's still about the determination of who is going to end up being the standard bearer for a party predicated on a national voting process. It ought to matter. And this is not just a theoretical and hypothetical exercise. This is the bedrock of what they say this is all about, the democracy. It's about voting. And for some constituencies, exercising a franchise hard won that people paid for with their lives. And this is what they're doing. And they're quite determined to follow suit again this year. This isn't the first year they've done this. But this is just so wrong. And they showed their cards real early. So that Bernie Sanders, fair is fair. The man ran a campaign, a fantastic campaign so far. An underdog campaign, the same that Jesse Jackson ran, the same that Barack Obama ran. He should get his delegates. It should not be a question. That should be the rule. The popular vote determining the delegates, give the man the delegates that come along with his popular win. There is no reason and there's no explanation that the Democratic Party could offer other than to say, well, this is our rules. I don't care about what rules you have. I think when somebody wins, you give them the delegates that they earned. Fair and square. There is no way that Hillary Clinton should have all these hundreds of delegates in her pocket because the Democratic Party decided that it is within its right to undermine the system. Well, I just wanted to get that said today because, you know, we talk about democracy a lot and we talk about voting a lot. And we see all these signs of people running around exhorting people to vote and participate. And this is the kind of crap that's going on in your face to undermine and to railroad the popular vote. It is wrong. And it needs to be said. Beyond being said, people need, you see, I believe you got to punish this party for it. It deserves to be punished. But that's our job. We have to figure out what to do. But we certainly should know what we shouldn't do. We should never support a party that operates this way. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Infectious Myth with David Crowe. You can reach me always at leadstories@gmail.com. Let me know what you think about this program and the program that we continue to do every day of the week. A pleasure always and a great privilege to be in your company. I'm trying my best to keep pace with my communication, and I'll be caught up soon. But thank you so much for your kind thoughts, for your support, and for your continued, I hope, spreading the word about PRN and about Lead Stories, your favorite program on PRN.FM. Take care. We'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye. Woman.